of summer elegance, Goodyear tire and rubber. I see the councilor set up and ready to go. Mr. Lowe.
There are two separate and independent reasons why the plaintiffs in this case are not entitled to a $550,000 windfall. First, the email from Goodyear's counsel was not an offer. It used no language indicating that Goodyear wished to enter into a contract. Instead, it submitted calculations of the amounts to pay off the judgment and invited plaintiffs' counsel to review them and discuss them. Second, even if there were an offer and acceptance, Goodyear is entitled to relief from the contract because plaintiffs admit that they had reason to know that the alleged offer contained a huge mistake. Either of these two reasons is sufficient for reversal. I turn first to the absence of an offer. The parties in this case agree that to be an offer, a communication must be definitive. And the plaintiffs contend that the communication at issue here, the email from Goodyear's counsel, was definitive because attached to it were page after page of numerical calculations. And they say, see, those are very specific. But mere specificity as to amounts of money is not enough. To be an offer, a communication also must be specific about the author's intent to enter into a contract. For example, if I were to say to a person, I think your house is worth $405,000, that's very specific as to amount, but it is not an offer to buy that person's house. Similarly here, this email from Goodyear's counsel contained no words of offer. It did not say Goodyear offers to settle, Goodyear is willing to pay, or anything of the sort. Instead, it sent numbers and it asked opposing counsel to review and discuss them. In evaluating this communication, I think the context at the time is very important, which that is legally relevant as part of the understanding of the objective understanding of the parties. And the context here was that there had been communications between Michael Brooks, the lawyer for Goodyear, and Lee Gray, the lawyer for the plaintiffs. And as a result of these communications, the two lawyers had learned that their calculations of the amount to pay off the judgment were different by about six figures. And so Mr. Brooks or Mr. Gray had to go first in order to show their calculations to the other. They have this discrepancy, but neither one knows who's right. And so this is never going to be resolved unless one side or the other says, okay, I'm going to lay down my cards. Here are my calculations. And Mr. Brooks was the one who went first. And that's what this email was. And so he did his calculations, and he attached them to an email. And did he say, here are the final calculations they were willing to pay? No. He said, attached are charts containing the numbers that we believe to be appropriate for the Summerell plaintiffs. And then a couple of irrelevant sentences, and then the payoff sentence, which we think is very important. Please review these, then let's discuss. Notably, the email does not suggest to the recipient, Mr. Gray, please let me know whether you accept or reject. It invited discussion, not acceptance.
Does it have to have such language, Mr. Lowe?
No, but if it's going to, if there is a question, the fact that it specifically invites discussion, conversation, i.e. further discussion, possibly contemplating a future offer, but who knows, is significant. But no, it certainly does not have to.
Mr. Lowe, after the telephone conversation in which one of the attorneys indicated that they had accepted the offer, there were no such discussions that you're talking about. The side that had supposedly made the offer did not call back and say, wait a minute, we asked for discussion, we needed to discuss this, not we weren't putting this out there for acceptance. Instead, they prepared documents to effectuate a settlement. So isn't that an objective indication that the writer of that email viewed it as an offer?
Your Honor, no. This is somewhat subtle, but I think important. The communications up to this point had been exclusively between Mr. Brooks and Mr. Gray. That is the communications about the amount. The final email came from Mr. Brooks to Mr. Gray. 5 days go by. When they call back to say they accept and then follow up with a letter, it's not addressed to Mr. Brooks. It's addressed to a completely different lawyer at a different law firm representing Goodyear. I think we can all draw our own inferences from that, but in any event, Mr. Brooks initially was not in the loop. And eventually, when he did learn that the settlement was going forward, he was entitled to assume either that the other lawyers had covered that point, or that when plaintiff's counsel called back and said, we accept, that was the equivalent of saying, yep, we agree with your numbers. In any event, we contend that based on these points, that there is no offer, and therefore that the purported acceptance is meaningless. Now, if the court agrees with us up to this point, then there's no need to go any further. That's sufficient for reversal and remand with instructions to deny the motion to enforce.
Can I take you back for a second, counsel?
Certainly, Your Honor.
This email is sent on
November 2nd.
November 2nd, okay. The trial court found, I'm looking at the findings this afternoon, that the parties still had not agreed on an accrual date as of October 12th. What is the finding with respect to an agreement on accrual date by the point that the email is sent? Do we have any findings on that point or any?
Your Honor has correctly stated the holding of the district court, and we did not appeal that point. The district, originally at one point, Goodyear had argued that there was an agreement already as of October 12th as to the accrual dates, and all that was left was the ministerial act of calculating the amount. The trial judge rejected that and concluded that there was still no final agreement that was binding on either party on any subject as of November 2nd. So that leaves the field kind of wide open. Our position now is that the November 2nd communication was not an offer and therefore could not be accepted.
Could the court make that finding a fact without holding a hearing?
I don't characterize it as a finding of fact, Your Honor. What we're dealing with here is a mixed question of law and fact, where we have evidentiary facts and then we have conclusions to be drawn from them. As it turns out, the evidentiary facts are almost entirely undisputed. And the only thing that the judge was doing, and I think he was right about this, he was determining the legal significance of the undisputed facts. And the standard of review there, of course, is de novo as to his conclusions.
But the question of whether the parties had reached an agreement as to the accrual dates is a finding of historical fact, isn't it?
It is not, Your Honor.
Okay.
What the findings of historical fact, according to the case law that we've cited in the standard of review section in the briefs, would be things like what was said, what date they were said, and so on. Then once you have all of the communications spread out before the court, the conclusion as to whether those facts amount to contract or no contract is a conclusion of law. And I would refer the case to the court to the DeFrancesco case on that point, which is cited in the brief.
Counsel, and forgive me, I have a bit of a cough, so I'll ask all counsel to forgive me. Does the accrual date issue even matter anymore at this point when they agreed on it? I think there's no dispute as of now that y'all agreed on the accrual dates, and if I understood, you've already paid the amounts that were not in dispute. Am I right about that?
You are absolutely correct, Your Honor, in everything you said.
All right, so there's no issue before us today on any fight about the accrual dates. The parties, as far as you're concerned, all agreed on the dates. There's no dispute about what the accrual dates were, true?
Yeah, it's all been settled up. Goodyear has paid everything except this disputed overage amount.
So is it undisputed that when Mr. Brooks and Mr. Gray were communicating with each other, the only thing they were doing is trying to hammer out the mathematical calculations based on those agreed upon accrual dates?
Well, you were right about everything, Your Honor, until you got to the word agreed upon accrual dates. As the district court held, and we have not appealed, although we actually disagree, there was no binding contract as to the accrual dates prior to November 2nd. It is certainly true, though, as Your Honor said, that what the two lawyers were doing at that point was trying to hammer out the calculation, trying to get their calculations in sync as to how much money would be reflected by these particular accrual dates.
I see. So they clearly were reflecting the premise that these were the accrual dates.
The assumption was that it was going to be these accrual dates. plaintiffs were saying, we can't say yes or no until we see specific dollar amounts for each plaintiff. And so they were trying to calculate the specific dollar amounts for each plaintiff, so it would then go to the plaintiffs, and the plaintiffs could say yes or no, and ultimately they all said yes.
Once the accrual dates were established, counsel, this should have been a mathematical computation, isn't that right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I briefly want to touch base with the second point. If the court does not agree with our analysis that there's no offer, then of course there would be a contract, and then we're seeking relief from the contract, which is an equitable concept. We've spread out all of the law on this point before the court. We particularly think that the Powderhorn case is highly significant and with immaterial distinctions really is on point here. Basically,
well, the court in Powderhorn did focus, Mr. Lowe, did it not, on the fact that there was a rejection or withdrawal before the other side accepted?
Indeed, Your Honor.
So would you address that point?
Absolutely. What the Supreme Court was driving at, I think, was that before the city purported to accept the offer, it knew that it was wrong. It doesn't matter how the city learned. If the city had found out on its own that there was a mathematical error in the bid, the result would have been the same. It happened to be that the offeror itself, the bidder, was the one who figured it out and told the city, there's an error in it, I want to withdraw. The only difference between that case and our case is that here the plaintiffs themselves figured out the error. But in both cases, the offeree, when the offeree accepted, was aware of the error in the bid. And very simple, Powderhorn, as far as we can tell, is consistent with every other case that we have been able to find anywhere in the country that has the following features. A mistaken offer or bid that is of a clerical nature, which is known to the offeree at the time of acceptance, and where the offeree has not detrimentally relied on the contract, justifiably detrimentally relied on the contract in the meantime. When those circumstances are present, as they are here, we have not found a single case in which an appellate court was willing to enforce a mistaken contract. And I want to briefly suggest the reason, and then I want to reserve the rest of my time. I think, Your Honor, the reason is that we are in an area of the law which is equitable. Relief from a contract is part of the law of equity. The position that Goodyear presents today is 100% equitable to both sides. That is, if Goodyear's position is sustained, Goodyear will pay everything that it owes, but nothing more, while plaintiffs will receive everything that they are legitimately due under the contract and receive nothing more. Equitable on both sides. But if the plaintiff's position is sustained, then Goodyear will suffer an undeserved loss of more than $500,000, and the plaintiffs will get a jackpot of more than $500,000. Again, inequitable on both sides. We suggest that the equitable result is the correct one here. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, please.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Mashaki.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Steve Mashaki arguing for the homeowners. Your Honors, there was offer and acceptance here, as was shown in spades by Goodyear's subsequent conduct after the exchange of the email and the letter. And furthermore, when parties are negotiating a settlement of litigation, they pursue their own interests, and prior to agreement, as this court held in Poly Trucking, they have no duty to disclose to the other side a mistake. And furthermore, Mr. Lowe is wrong when he said there's no court in the United States that has found under these circumstances that rescission wouldn't be granted. Poly Trucking is such a case. In addition to dealing with the restatement of torts section 551 issue, the court in Poly Trucking specifically dealt with the argument that the lawyers for the plaintiff knew or should have known that there was a mistake made by the other side. And this court said, no, not good enough. That's not an equitable conduct. In the context of a litigation settlement where parties are negotiating over a dispute and there's simply silence rather than affirmative misrepresentation, we're going to enforce the agreement.
Mr. Mashaki, you're making several big assumptions here, the first of which is that there was any settlement negotiation here. You have a judgment. The jury's already decided allocations of fault. Isn't it correct that the only thing that had to be done on remand was to figure out the accrual date and then do math?
You had to figure out the accrual date. There were, and it was more than just for these four plaintiffs. But you did have to figure out the accrual date, and then you had to apply the decision and the jury's allocation of fault, and in addition to that, do math.
Right.
That's correct.
There was no negotiation over numbers, as I can gather from the correspondence between Mr. Brooks and Mr. Gray. They were trying to figure out a discrepancy.
They were trying to figure out a discrepancy, but furthermore, what they were trying to do was get specific offers from these for these plaintiffs. In other words...
Well, that's what I'm getting at. What's there to be offered? I mean, the only thing that needs to be done, I will grant, we can offer, okay, we need to decide the accrual dates. And first of all, would you confirm for me that there is no dispute anymore about the accrual dates? That's all been resolved?
I think that's correct.
Okay. So once that's resolved, there's no numbers. It's just math. Where is the negotiation?
Well, it's more than math, Your Honor. There are underlying assumptions. There are assumptions underlying that math. Particularly, there is the assumption of the jury's allocation of fault, and that's where the mistake was here. There wasn't a mistake in math. Mr. Brooks didn't multiply $500,000 by 48% and come up with 10. That wasn't the mistake here. It wasn't a clerical error, and it wasn't a math error. He made a mistake in the assumption underlying his numbers.
Mr. Shockey, I want to stop you there because it seems to me in mathematical terms, all he did was put in the wrong number for the variable. The variable being the jury's allocation of a percentage of fault. That's a percentage. He put in the wrong percentage. That's just putting in the wrong number in a variable. Why isn't that a mathematical error?
I think it's different because, again, we're talking about an allocation of fault by the jury. There was a prior decision here.
But one that nobody could dispute. I mean, again, not subject to negotiation. That was set in stone at this point. So he just mistakenly put 100 instead of whatever it was, 40-something percent.
He did do that, but I think it's a little more than that again. In other words, he didn't – a math error is something where you're making an error in sums or multiplication or division or something along those lines. There were certain – they themselves said, well, there were 13 different calculations we had to do to come up with this number, and there are all sorts of assumptions we had to make in the process. So they made a mistake in one of those assumptions. They didn't apply the allocation of fault to the that particular calculation. So again, we believe that this is different than a math error, different from a clerical error. It is an error in an underlying assumption, an assumption that underlies that math, no different than if someone says, well, you know, we want to include 50 board feet of wood, and in fact they included 10. And there would be a different, of course, you know, if 10 times something is different than 50 times something. It's the same kind of thing you're talking about.
What is the significance, if we accept your characterization, how does that apply here? Does that change the contextual analysis as to whether that was an offer, or does it change this rescission argument?
No, it applies in the context of mistake of fact. Because here's what Mr. Lowe was talking about, Powderhorn, and Powderhorn specifically says that if prior to acceptance you're notified about an error and the error is clerical or mathematical in nature, then there is grounds for avoidance of the contract. So it relates to that issue, not to the issue of offer.
Let's go back to the former, the first argument, which has to do with the context. I guess in that context, it doesn't make any difference whether this can fairly be characterized as a mathematical error or simply putting in the wrong variable in the calculation. It informs our sense that the parties were discussing not an amount that was really fairly subject to dispute. It was really, once the accrual dates were settled, everything was quite mechanical from there, even if it's not, strictly speaking, a mathematical error. And doesn't that yield the conclusion that this is not a context that we could expect an offer to come from?
Not a context we could expect an offer to come from.
In other words, why would we make an offer that would be why would a party make an offer to say this is a kind of this is our position, our way of liquidating the uncertainty here, because there is no uncertainty to liquidate.
Well, there was an uncertainty to liquidate, which was there was only a lump sum offer at that point in time. It was and it wasn't even a specific amount. It was, well, we think it's about $2.7 million.
But it wasn't an offer, Mr. Mishaki. It was a calculation. We have the accrual dates. Here's the number I come up with. It's about $2.7 million. I think that's what Judge Russell is getting at. This is not a context where they're negotiating the number. This is a context where once we have the accrual dates, we figure out the math, we're comparing numbers, and we're off by six figures. Where's the problem? Is that a context in which you'd expect an offer?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. We had six plaintiffs, remember, on our side of the case. So these plaintiffs, we couldn't even convey those offers to our clients until we got a specific number for each one, and each of those clients said, yeah, I'm okay with that number. Because remember, our clients are back there saying, well, how much is this going to yield me total? And then I've got to decide as a client, well, is that good enough for me, or do I want to send my lawyer back in there and negotiate more on these accrual dates, because I want more than that.
But
now, $100,000 isn't enough for me.
That's the variable, right, the accrual date.
Because once you had the accrual date, you could communicate with your client all on your own what that number was going to be.
That's correct. Based on our own calculations, we could do that.
So...
Let me ask Mr. Mishaki on this issue of offer. Goodyear cited a bunch of cases on the too good to be true kind of doctrine.
Yes.
Are you aware of any Colorado cases that either adopt that or reject it?
I'm not aware of either, Your Honor.
Okay.
And furthermore, the two cases that they rely on here with respect to, I really think that they're focusing on the second part of the definition of an offer. In terms of whether the acceptor's understanding that their assent is wanted is justified. And we haven't found any case where there was actually an intent to make an offer, but there was a mistake in it where the court said, well, there was no offer. And the two cases they cite, there was no intent to make any offer at all. In one of them, there was a mistaken payment made for rent after a lease was canceled. There was no intent at all to make that payment. The other case, likewise, there was no authority. The person who conveyed the supposed offer had no authority. So we're not aware of any case where that kind of analysis is applied in the context of the definition of an offer. And indeed, it would really eviscerate the doctrine of mistake if you think about it. There are legions of cases out there where an offer was made based on mistakes, and sometimes mistakes much larger than the one here. We cited the case from Washington, the Conley case, where there was a $2 million mistake. And the courts don't look at it and say, well, the mistake was so big, there was no offer, or because you had reason to know, there was no offer. They look at it in terms of the doctrine of mistake, and they apply typically the restatement test, which incidentally hasn't been adopted yet in Colorado, although it's mentioned in the footnote in Powderhorn. But that's the way the courts analyze these things. They don't analyze it under the rubric of offer.
Mr. Mishaki, what do you, in terms of the offer, what do you make of the language in the email that said, here's the numbers Goodyear believes to be, and please review and call me? It seems to me if we were to adopt the restatement test, it says the offer needs to be requesting assent. This document email seemed to be requesting a return call, further discussion. Could you respond to that?
Yes, I have two responses. One is to look at what went before. The other is to look at what went after. If you look at what went before, again, the party's lawyers were negotiating and repeatedly were talking about, well, there's this $2.7 million ballpark figure out there, and Mr. Gray is repeatedly saying, I need specific plaintiff-by-plaintiff breakdowns so that we can convey offers to our clients. And then finally we get the email. And so that's the email we're waiting for. So in the context of the discussions that came before, those were offers. And then as I think Judge Jones was pointing out, afterwards, the subsequent conduct was not when Mr. Mayward accepted the offer both orally in a phone call and via letter. The response from Goodyear wasn't, oh, you made a mistake. We just wanted to talk about this more. The response from Goodyear was, here's a satisfaction of judgment, and we've already given wire instructions to our client to wire the funds to you. Obviously, that subsequent conduct is indicating what their own belief contemporaneously, not after the fact when we're here in the appellate court a couple years later, but contemporaneously it shows what they thought about that offer and acceptance.
But isn't that equally consistent with Mr. Brooks thinking that he had figured out what the disparity was? That's what he says. You know, I thought I sent the numbers. Somebody had to go first because I thought I'd figured it out.
Yep. Well, now we're getting into the issue under 154 as to whether Goodyear bears the risk of the mistake here. And the rubric courts have used here is either conscious uncertainty or conscious ignorance. And the context here was that Brooks was told about this six-figure discrepancy. And he never confirmed that his theory was correct. He had a theory, and that's all he had. And he never confirmed that that theory is correct. He never asked us. He never asked for our calculations. He never asked Mr. Gray to tell him anything. And they went forward, and they made the contract. And so, in our view, because of that, Goodyear indeed bore the risk of any mistake on Brooks's part here.
Well, what do you make then in section 153 of the restatement? One of the comments specifically says, quote, "It is of course unusual for a party to bear the risk of a mistake that the other party had reason to know of." I mean, you guys concede that you had reason to know of this problem.
That's correct.
So how does the argument you just made square with the restatement that you're citing?
It squares perfectly with the restatement in terms of the black letter law, first of all. 153 says that you get relief if the party doesn't bear the risk of mistake and either reason to know or unconscionability. So the black letter rule itself presupposes that there are circumstances under which you can have reason to know and yet still the other party is denied relief because of their conscious ignorance. And the same is true in mutual mistake. The same rule applies there. When you have a mutual mistake, it's not automatically voidable. You still do this reason to know test. And again, we've cited you, I think, five cases where courts concluded that indeed, even though there might have been reason to know or a mutual mistake, parties were held to their agreement because of this conscious ignorance principle.
Mr. Mishaki, just to change gears a little bit, how, if at all, did your clients rely to their detriment on the November 2nd offer?
Well, I would say only in the sense that they could have chosen to negotiate for something else. In other words, once we finally had those numbers, finally got the plaintiff by plaintiff offers and sent them to our clients after the 2nd of November, if the numbers were different and lower, they could have chosen to say, "I want you to negotiate for more." That would be the only way in which they would have relied to their detriment.
On a related note,
yes.
What are the equities that favor your position in this case?
The equities that favor our position, again, I think are frankly, what is a lawyer supposed to do in the litigation context? Here we are, we get this offer. The court here, and it's undisputed, the court here said, not only did we have duty to disclose, we had a 1.6 duty not to say anything to the other side.
I'm surprised at that finding. Now, I admittedly have not reviewed the rules, but if the rules require that strikes me as being very odd. It seems to me the decent and ethical thing to do would be call up the other side and say, "Look, I think you made a mistake here."
Well, and Your Honor, there is an ethics opinion that this was all discussed, and if you read the trial court briefs, you'll see this. But there's a CBA ethics opinion, Opinion 80, and there's a treatise that I co-authored that they cited, I think, trying to say that I was being inconsistent, that deals with this issue. And what that holds is that, again, prior to agreement, you have no duty to say anything. And in fact, you've got a rule 1.6 duty to say nothing.
I know your time is up, but this point bothers me significantly. If you had a duty to say nothing, then how was it appropriate for Mr. Gray to say there's a six-figure mistake? You can't have it both ways.
Well, again, I can't, first of all, discuss what was said between Mr. Gray and our client, so I'll have to give you, I guess, a partial response.
No, this is to Mr. Brooks.
Yes, that's right. There is an exception for the rule when the disclosure is impliedly authorized. There's also an exception for client consent, and I think that's the most I can say in response to that question. Did I finish answering your question, Your Honor?
I think so. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to just quickly address the points that Mr. Mushaki made concerning the case law. He said that Poly Trucking would support his case. It does not, because it is easily distinguishable, because contrary to what Mr. Mushaki said, the actual facts in that case were that Poly did not know of Concentra's mistake. If you look at the pinpoint site at 93 Pacific 3rd at page 566, first full paragraph, you will see that the court goes on to give one sentence of dicta, and that sentence starts off, even if Poly had been cognizant of Concentra's intent to obtain a release of the doctors, dot, 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 they go on to say it wouldn't have made any difference to the court. It's clearly dicta, and as that dictum shows, the actual facts in that case were that Poly was not aware. Then he cited the Washington case, that's the CPL Delaware versus Conley. That case is, again, easily distinguishable because there, after the money had been paid, the party that had received the money turned around and paid it all out to its investors. And so when the other party said, oops, I made a mistake, I want it back, the party that had done all that said, I don't have the money anymore, I can't get it back. So clear reliance to that party's detriment. Another one of the cases they cite in their brief is a Wyoming Supreme Court case. As you will see, if you look at that, you will find that that is not a mistake case at all. That is simply a case where somebody acted without knowledge of a material fact, clearly not a mistake case. There was, changing the subject now, with my limited time left, there was discussion of mathematical errors. I just want to point out that this doctrine is not limited to mathematical errors. The word that's used in Powderhorn is clerical errors, and I think our error clearly falls in that category. as to Section 154, I would simply point the court to subsection C of Section 154, which allows the court to place the risk wherever it deems appropriate in order to do equity. Thank you.
Thank you.
Court thanks both counsel for their arguments. In this case, will stand submitted, and the written opinion will